Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Dr. Craig Stockings appears for the first time at the Sydney Institute. I've followed his work for a number of years, and it's great to have him here. I will introduce our speaker briefly. Dr. Stockings is a senior lecturer in history at the University of New South Wales, based in Canberra. His areas of academic interest concern general and Australian military history and operational analysis. He has recently published A History of the Army Cadet Movement in Australia, The Torch and the Sword, Viridia, Myth, Reality and the Heirs of the Anzacs, and a study of the first Libyan campaign in North Africa, and forthcoming a book on the Greek campaign. But he's also the general editor of two important books, Zombie Myths of Australian Military History, The Ten Myths That Will Not Die, and after that, Anzac's Dirty Dozen, 12 Myths of Australian Military History. Both books are engaged in looking at mythology and attacking mythology. And it's for one of these reasons that Dr. Stocking's here tonight. It relates to the chapter he has in the second book. And so the topic of tonight's talk is Other People's Wars, an assessment of Australian military commitments. Dr. Stockings, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, please allow me to thank Gerard and Anne and the Institute for the opportunity to speak with you tonight. I do consider it a real privilege, as well as being a personal pleasure. As Gerard indicated, by trade I am a military historian, and tonight I'm going to talk to you about what I would call an important theme, or perhaps a premise, that permeates not just the public imagination of Australia's military past, but wider social and scholarly circles as well. The idea of which I speak is the notion that somehow Australians, throughout this nation's history, have fought and have died in other people's wars. Let me nail my colours to the mast at the very outset and say that this is a mistaken idea. In one of his recent documentaries, the Australian-born filmmaker John Pilger described how we have, and I'm quoting him, a special relationship with war. We fight, Pilger contends, mostly against people with whom we have no quarrel and who offer us no threat of invasion. Australians have thus paid a unique blood sacrifice in order to appease a great protector, end of his quote. The nation has, in other words, largely fought in other people's conflicts as unnecessary as have been costly. We've done so either out of unthinking fidelity to great power protectors, either Britain or more recently the United States, or as a consequence of being duped or otherwise manipulated by these big brother allies. And as I mentioned, Pilger is certainly not alone in this view. In an academic anthology published in 2010, Professors Marilyn Lake and Henry Reynolds, for example, made similar arguments. And they noted that, and I'm quoting them, engagement in foreign wars has been one of the most distinctive features of Australia's 20th century history. Many of these are what are now commonly called wars of choice rather than wars of necessity. The implication, again, is that Australia ought to have kept its nose well out of conflicts that did not concern it. Well, it's not my purpose here this evening to make moral judgment on the wars fought from Australians from the colonial era to the present, nor am I tonight concerned really so much with the outcome of those wars and questions of whether or not the manifold aims of various expeditions we've sent abroad have been met. Rather, I seek to specifically and to singly address the idea that these wars have belonged to other people, that Australian policymakers have consistently been victims of their own sentimentality to towards great and powerful friends, all being bullied, all being duped into appeasing these allies through military commitments better avoided, with little or no intrinsic consequence to Australia. This idea, while it may well have had, and no doubt still has, significant appeal to various political and intellectual agendas, simply fails to stack up to historical scrutiny or evidenced argument. Australia's wars have been her own. For better or for worse, successive Australian governments have chosen when and where to fight. They've done so in the main for cold, calculating and real politic reasons. Now, this is not to suggest that powerful cultural and emotional connections or appeals to the patriotism of empire, or more recently the apparent need to impose freedom or democracy, have not existed or played their part, especially as recruiting tools. Neither is it to suggest that soldiers past or present have not ardently believed in the righteousness of their cause, or that our allies have not sought to shape Australian decision making to suit their own ends. In all cases, however, there is a need to pierce the shroud that invariably accompanies decisions to participate in war. Private soldiers, private citizens, do not choose when and where to commit themselves to armed conflict. They deploy and sometimes die on the orders of their government. Australian politicians have made such choices according to rationalist and realist principles, not sentiment and not coercion. Well, in order to focus this pretty general argument, I'll spend some time examining the decision to send the 2nd Australian Imperial Force in World War II to the Middle East, a decision made in late 1939. This is not a random or arbitrary choice, for if ever there was a military expedition that would support the case for the prosecution, as it were, it would be this one. For here was a choice: to commit the nation's only fully armed and equipped regular and full-time formation halfway around the world at Britain's call to protect British interests in North Africa from potential Italian aggression. Of what import the fate of Egypt to Australia? Why should Australians fight and die against an Italian enemy? The Germans were nowhere near Africa at this stage in the war. As events would show, even the Suez Canal was not of any significant economic consideration to Australia. A Mussolini's reach would never threaten the Pacific. Moreover, this was a decision made in the context of an emerging and an acknowledged threat from Japan. Why did arguments for keeping Australians, our soldiers at home, to balance this menace fail? Surely this was a case of committing to one of Pilger's other people's wars. Well, in truth, despite claims over time by many a prominent author, Australia did not move to war in 1939 or decide upon the deployments of its soldiers to far-flung battlefields as an automatic consequence of British decision-making, duplicity or pressure. The choice was quite deliberate and had been forming for a number of weeks as inevitability of hostilities in Europe grew. Neither naivety nor blind imperial loyalty tipped the government's hand here. The decision was, in fact, entirely congruent with what appeared to be, at the time, the national interest, particularly the value placed in the idea of resistance to international aggression and the concept of imperial defence. Let me pause there, because that's a keystone principle. This is the traditional idea that British strength was the best guarantor of Australian security. It was a keystone principle. For the empire to be strong anywhere, which is important to Australia, it needed to be strong everywhere. Australia, therefore, ought to fight the empire's wars so if the day of crisis ever came, then Britain, or more particularly the Royal Navy, would be there in Australia's hour of need. But with the decision or declaration of war, the question of what action Australia ought to take beyond passive measures at home became a topic of heated parliamentary and public debate. And the first obstacle to overcome with respect to an Australian expeditionary force was political. For if ready to accept Menzies' decision for war, the Australian Labor Party was much less willing to countenance the idea of an expeditionary force for potential overseas service, even though there were standing military contingencies for such a plan. While outwardly maintaining the line that he would wait and see what Britain requested before making a decision, Menzies too was hesitant for strategic reasons. On the 5th September, he cabled Stanley Bruce, the Australian High Commissioner, in London to inform him that until Japanese intentions were clear, it is pointless even to discuss the idea. Menzies was, despite what we might like to think of him, from the earliest stages, never a British stooge, nor inspired to make a decision by emotional or imperial sentiment in this case. There was, however, a long-term British expectation that such a force would be, depart from Australia should it be required, and pressure from Whitehall began to mount, but with remarkably little impact at the time, despite British assurances of the contrary, and on the advice of the Australian Military Board, a calculating Menzies remained concerned about the Japanese. But the political pressure on the Prime Minister ratcheted up a notch when on the 9th September the New Zealand government announced the decision to raise its own special force in support of Britain. This was invaluable ammunition to the press, almost uniformly in support of an increased Australian commitment to the war. And eventually, under siege from all sides, an unsettled and a reluctant Prime Minister made a choice. Again, using radio rather than parliamentary procedure, on the 15th of September, during his regular Friday broadcast, Menzies announced the raising of a full-time force to be used in Australia or overseas, as circumstances permit. Yet the issue of whether this force would ever be sent from Australian shores, and if so to where, remained a serious conundrum for the government. November 1939 saw considerable political and military debate as to whether this force would ever go anywhere. Again, the point is, the choice was far from automatic. Ironically, Lieutenant General E.K. Squires, a British officer acting as Chief of the Australian General Staff, believed that the possibility for dispatching this force existed, but only when the danger of attack on Australia was removed. Squires was supported by Menzies, who was, as I've noted, similarly cautious about committing Australian soldiers to a faraway theatre of war. Yet the slow transition from attitudes of careful regard for Australian security, the ones that placed Australians on board ships bound to the Middle East, began to gather speed. Increasing public pressure to dispatch ground forces was mirrored by some prominent personalities in London, including Winston Churchill. It followed a string of nebulous and unspecific British pledges to underwrite Australian security in exchange for troops. Yet the ironclad guarantee Menzies sought could not and would not be given. The truth was that depending on the fortunes of war, Australia could be sure of neither Britain's ability nor its intention to fulfil any implied promises. But the essential point is the Australian government knew this. If the British were trying to dupe the Prime Minister, cable traffic makes it clear they most assuredly failed. Yet so deep-rooted the idea of imperial defence, so reliant Australia on British intelligence estimates of Japanese intentions, that throughout November 1939 pressure mounted at home and in London. Menzies, however, was still hesitant while Japanese intentions were unknown. The British response to his position grew ever more pointed, suggesting the need for more troops in France and stressing the remoteness of the Japanese spectre. And finally, such lobbying bore fruit. On the 14th of November, the Australian service chiefs recommended to Cabinet that this force be sent abroad. Still, however, Menzies demurred and deferred a decision on the issue to a full Cabinet meeting at the end of the month. In the interim, he sought further assurances and further British guarantees of security and received no shortage of promises in return. Yet for the time being, political oppositions, doubts about British honesty in its estimations of the Japanese threat, combined with a lack of land fighting in Europe during the period known as the Phoney War, persuaded Menzies to continue to hold off from sending Australian troops. Well, once again, policy decisions taken across the Tasman helped force the Prime Minister's hand. Seemingly far less concerned about the Japanese, on the 20th of November, the New Zealanders announced a decision to send their own expeditionary force abroad. And for a second time, the Prime Minister was subject to unfavourable press comparisons and he began to fall into step. Yet a conversation between Menzies and the British High Commissioner as late as the 23rd of November 1939 revealed that even at this hour, the Prime Minister harboured considerable misgivings. There was little room left, however, in which he could manoeuvre. 5 days later, Cabinet at last decided the force would sail, as soon as it had reached a suitable stage of training. Menzies did have lingering doubts. Under pressure from many fronts, the decision was made. So, where are we? A long string of decisions in Canberra, London, and to some extent Rome, had conspired to place Australian soldiers in the Middle East in 1940. For the Australians, this decision-making process was lengthy, fought out in Parliament, fought out in the press, and at no point was the eventual outcome a sure thing. The machinations surrounding the commitment were never as straightforward as proponents of the other people's war's ideas might like to suggest. Blind loyalty to Britain clearly did not tip Menzies' hand. Rather, he was consistently suspicious of British assurances and unswayed by British efforts to shape his decision-making. The Australian government, on the advice of the Australian military, was also quite conscious of a potential risk posed by the Japanese. In the end, the decision was made according to the established principles of imperial defence. And let's remember, this was a construct not of sentiment, but a logical consequence to Australia's standing security dilemma. Australian policymakers sent troops abroad in World War II with their eyes wide open. To commit to war in the Middle East on such a basis is just incompatible with the notion of unwillingly, unwittingly, unnecessarily fighting other people's wars. The important point, though, is the example set by this decision in the early stages of World War II is representative of a consistent historical pattern. Australia's earliest and colonial military expeditions to places like the Sudan in 1885, to South Africa in 1899, are two cases in point. Proponents of the other people's war or idea describe such commitments often as Australia foolishly participating in, rather than avoiding, unnecessary foreign wars. In the case of the Boer War, instead of remaining neutral, the six Australian colonies and then the new Commonwealth sent thousands of troops to fight alongside British forces against two small Boer republics for no better reason than loyalty to the Queen and sentiment for the Empire. Or so the story goes. Such an interpretation, of course, deliberately ignores the complicated reality of Australian and imperial identity in the period. In fact, in many ways, to suggest a commitment to Britain above and beyond a commitment to purely Australian interests is an entirely false construct. Most Australians at the turn of the century identified themselves not as Australians or subjects of empire, but both, in Alfred Deakin's words, independent Australian Britons. Any distinction between the two is the imposition of a contemporary worldview on an era which would have rejected it as foreign and inappropriate. Such an interpretation also conveniently ignores evidence of much more complex, always complex, Australian motives. In particular, to suggest an expedition to the Boer War was irrelevant to Australian security and strategic positioning is to demonstrate ignorance of the importance of the idea of imperial defence noted earlier in the minds of colonial and early Australian politicians. There was, of course, no chance that a newly federated Australia could defend itself from a large and aggressive foreign power. In this regard, we were entirely dependent on Britain. Imperial defence was the obvious and the only solution. In the words of the contemporary New South Wales political leader, Sir John Robinson, if we expect England to stand by us in any trouble, we ought to stand by England in her troubles. Now, public fervour and sentimentality were an important part of Australia's Boer War, but not at all the essence of the government's decision-making process. In Geoffrey Blainey's words, loyalty to England was paralleled by loyalty to Australia and its own interests. The two loyalties ran side by side. This was our war by rational and calculating choice, and the pattern is set. Many of the same arguments, both for and against the conception of Australia participating in other people's wars, carry over into World War I. Was it, as some cultural and social historians suggest, more naive folly and blind loyalty to Britain that sent some 60,000 Australians to early graves in places far distant from their homes? Here, in addition to the continuing influence of the idea of imperial defence, careful distinction must be made between the flag-waving rhetoric that encouraged so many to volunteer for expeditions to Gallipoli and France, with the forces and factors motivating their political elites to send them there. Was they not the same thing? Of course, the idea of assisting Britain in an hour of real need, as opposed to the situations encountered in the colonial era, was an intellectual and an emotional dynamic that cut across all sectors of the Australian community, but that was only one reason to raise and dispatch the first AIF. There is no question that Australia had strong financial, trading and strategic reasons for allying itself with Britain in this war. In fact, the decision to support Britain, should there be a general war in Europe, was essentially made by a succession of Australian governments of all political persuasions years before 1914. Had the Allies lost this war, the balance of power would have been, a balance of world power would have been radically altered to the detriment of Britain and Australia. There is no reason at all to suspect that Australian politicians in the early 20th century were less shrewd than they are 100 years later. They well knew the consequences should Britain face defeat and chose accordingly. Moreover, those questioning the wisdom of committing Australian lives to war in 1914 unsurprisingly often neglect to acknowledge that Germany was at the time a rising Pacific power with fortified harbours, modern wireless stations, including one at Rabaul in German New Guinea, and warships within steaming distance of Sydney, Perth and the Torres Straits. Once again, there is always much more to it than blind loyalty. Well, at the outset of World War II, in addition to the decision to dispatch another expeditionary force of Australians to the Middle East, as we've noted, was a commitment of so many Australians to the air war over Europe as part of the Empire Air Training Scheme, and the placement of the Royal Navy as more or less a component, Royal Australian Navy as more or less a component part of the Royal Navy. First, these air and sea commitments were justified philosophically under the same imperial defence rubric that I've discussed. Now, defeating Germany and the Axis powers most certainly did matter to Australia. Few would be so naive as to suggest a triumph of the Nazi worldview on polity would not have impacted Australians for the worse, with the war so clearly at the time and now viewed as a battle for the preservation of liberal democratic values against an alternate and abhorrent alternative. In what way might this conflict honestly be labelled as someone else's? All of this, of course, relates to the war in Europe and the Mediterranean. Those ascribing to the notion of habitual Australian involvement in wars better left alone in places so far from Australian shores as not to warrant a single drop of Australian blood often avoid a discussion of the Pacific War in its entirety. If it is acknowledged, then effort is usually made to artificially separate the Pacific away from the wider conflict as if they were not closely connected and integral aspects of the same conflict. Now, even without a detailed discussion, surely it's self-evident that the Pacific theatre, by no stretch of anyone's imagination, can seriously be considered as anything but Australia's concern. Well then, the tradition of rational cost-benefit calculations continues past 1945, well into the Cold War period. There was no sudden lurch to uncritically and automatically accede to the demands of powerful allies in the face of real Australian interests. With respect to the Korean War, it was difficult to argue that blind sentiment or loyalty underwrote the deployment when the Australian public reaction to the news of war was so distinctly subdued. Moreover, a military commitment here had been called by the United Nations, an organisation Australia had had a substantial hand in establishing and a significant interest in strengthening. At its heart, the idea of collective security. This concept was seen at the time, even if it's doubted now, as a key answer to Australia's strategic dilemma. Should collective security work in practice, it would guarantee the safety of not just this country, but other small to medium-sized nations throughout the globe. It would certainly not succeed if, at its first true test, nations like Australia failed to heed the call. A deployment to Korea was thus, in every sense, in line with what was perceived at the time as the Australian national interest, and by the way, received consistent bipartisan support. Well, throughout the same period, as I'm sure many of you are aware, Australia also committed troops to the Malayan emergency. Australian forces in Malaya formed part of this country's contribution to what was called the Far East Strategic Reserve, set up in April 1955 primarily to deter what was seen at the time as external communist aggression, particularly from China, against countries in Southeast Asia, like Malaya and like Singapore. Within a Cold War context, the emergency was in all aspects perceived in Canberra and London as a struggle against the danger of communist expansion in the region. Sensitive to a perceived communist threat to its north, the Australian government here was a willing participant. No wave of emotional delusion swept Australian policymakers to action. No British lies or coercion forced Australian hands. This was seen as a regional problem that demanded regional action. The same may well be said of the confrontation with the Indonesians from 1962 to 66. Australian commitment to operations against Indonesians in Borneo and West Malaysia again fell within the context of its membership of the Far East Strategic Reserve. Like the Malayan emergency, it represented a regional crisis with clearly perceived security ramifications for Australia. It was certainly not sentimentality or loyalty which sent Australian troops into harm's way here. Neither was it public opinion, in that because of the sensitivity of cross-border operations in Borneo, which were secret at the time, confrontation received very little coverage in the Australian press. Nor was it British pressure, as the Australian government stood aside from this conflict for a considerable amount of time, despite pleas from London and from Kuala Lumpur for help. Shrewd calculations of Australian interests then, as always, steered the ship of state. On a much larger scale, much more controversial, was the Australian commitment to Vietnam, which almost 60,000 Australians served. There are two typical elements to the standard other people's war interpretation or argument made by those set against the decision to commit troops to Vietnam. The first concerns how necessary such commitment really was, and the second the degree of US pressure placed on Australia. Well, in the first instance, while the tradition of public acceptance of government decisions to commit to war was perhaps shaken by Vietnam, the traditional pattern of realist, rational decision-making was not. Menzies, once again Prime Minister, his government, most of the Western world for that matter, subscribed to what was called the domino theory in Southeast Asia at the time. In a Cold War context, this theory seemed obvious. The clear Australian government consensus was that if the Vietnam War ended with an outcome that denied South Vietnam a real and protected independence, then Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, even Indonesia would find themselves vulnerable to further communist expansion. They would fall like dominoes right up to Australia's very doorstep. Now, this concept was a formidable reality, a reality to Australian policymakers who thought they were witnessing, were sure they were witnessing, the boundaries of an aggressive communism coming ever closer. Paul Hasluck, Minister for Defence in 1963 and 64, provides a good insight into his government's thinking. I'm quoting him here. "I need not emphasise the importance to Australia of the outcome of events in South Vietnam. Our plain national interest is to have a government there who will continue to fight the Viet Cong, to oppose North Vietnam, and to give some prospect to eventually unifying the country behind a stable anti-communist government, which will still provide the local circumstances to enable the US to keep a foothold in Southeast Asia." There is no case to be made in this context. At the time, the Australian government, Australians at large for that matter, saw the war as none of Australia's concern. That many sectors of the community changed their opinion as the war progressed, or that many Australians came to doubt the legitimacy of the war as a whole, are important aspects of Australia's Vietnam. But they are largely beside the point insofar as this argument is concerned. Now, Vietnam raised a second issue, used regularly by the proponents of the other people's war interpretation of Australian military history, and that is, Australia was somehow forced to war reluctantly by pressure applied from Washington. The US thus replaces Britain in the role of bullying great power ally, dragging the Australian government into a conflict better left alone, against its wishes and against its better judgment. A cable sent by Alan Renouf, the Australian ambassador in Washington in May 64, however, puts pay to this type of reasoning. Renouf explains, and I'm quoting from the cable, "Our objective should be to achieve such an habitual closeness of relations with the US and sense of mutual alliance that in our time of need, the US would have little option but to respond as we would want. The problem of Vietnam is one, it seems, where we could pick up a lot of credit with the US. But this problem is one to which the United States is deeply committed and in which it genuinely feels, it is carrying too much of the load. Not so much the physical load, the bulk of which the US is prepared to bear, as the moral load." Perhaps this sounds familiar. The Australian government was forced into nothing as far as Vietnam was concerned. The commitment was willing and entered into with a calculating clarity of purpose. In fact, as authors like Gregory Pemberton have shown, or rather systematically demonstrated, it was the Australians that urged a hawkish policy on the Americans when they seemed to vacillate. Far from being dragged into Vietnam, Australian diplomats and ministers actively encouraged the Americans to commit troops. This was done not out of any misguided loyalty or US pressure, but as a consequence of cold self-interest. Well then, the model established for Vietnam serves equally well when applied to the most recent Australian military commitments abroad. Serious and voluminous debate surrounded and continues to surround decisions to commit Australian troops to the occupation of Iraq, for example, and the ongoing subjugation of insurgents in Afghanistan. Again, the issue of legitimacy, or even morality, of both conflicts has from time to time assumed centre stage. Equally as important as these questions are, they are relevant to the idea of other people's wars. In years to come, Australian policymakers may well have difficult questions to answer with respect to what extent their decisions reflected the public will. The more blood and treasure spent in such places might also in time encourage future generations to judge the practical utility of such deployments. However, at the time the decisions were made, Renouf's position, 4 decades on, still captures the essence of the matter. There was no blind loyalty to Uncle Sam here. There is little evidence to suggest wholesale deception of the Australian government by Washington, although false US claims as to the presence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq were perhaps a partial exception. Nor is there sufficient proof of external pressure as a decisive factor. The commitments made were perceived as sufficient to achieve government policy objectives. Well, to sum up and conclude, in my opinion, there are many reasons for the genesis and perpetuation of the other people's wars misconception as it pertains to the military history of this country. At one level, perhaps, I think it might make the loss of life involved in the world wars, catastrophic as it was, a little bit easier to accept. It's somehow comforting to shake our heads at the tragic sentimentality of empire and the horror that it wrought upon our forebears. Alternatively, when the rightness of the cause in which Australians have fought and died for seems open to dispute, from the Veldt to Vietnam, it eases our collective conscience to suggest we were somehow tricked or pressured into doing someone else's dirty work. And there remains a powerful temptation to believe in our own enduring historic innocence in this regard. In all every case, however, the historical trail leads elsewhere. A myth is a myth. A half-truth is no truth at all. Australia's wars have been Australian choices, or at least the consequence of willing decisions of Australian politicians and policymakers in pursuit of what they thought was a national interest. No enemy, apart perhaps from Arthur Phillip, has yet to land on Australian shores. We have chosen when and where we've fought. Nor do students of politics and history ought this be any great surprise. Long ago, Clausewitz defined war as an innately political act with distinctly political objectives. That generations of Australian governments has followed Clausewitz's dictum is axiomatic. As noted at the very beginning of my talk, ladies and gentlemen, none of this at all is a commentary on the correctness of these wars or our participation in them, in moral or even practical terms. Rather, the singular point is Australians have never, not once, by any stretch, fought other people's wars. Thank you.
Craig Stuckings, thank you very much. We'll come to questions and discussion in a minute. As I mentioned before, we've got copies of the Dr. Stuckings' edited collections on mythology, all the way from the Boer War on. And I'm sure he'd be happy to sign any copies if you'd like it. Janet Grundy's got some copies outside. So we come to questions and discussion. You've written across a number of areas of Australian history and politics, but tonight you're talking about mythology, and these are the subjects of your recent edited collections. But as an academic in a university, it must be a difficult task, because if you look at the concept of other people's wars, you've got popular films like Gallipoli, you've got best-selling sort of quick histories of John Pilger, you've got recent ABC documentaries, one on Vietnam, one a couple of years ago on Menzies in the early part of World War II, which just proclaim and repeat all these mythologies. So how does one tackle mythology in the general public debate as distinct from recording it in books and in occasional lectures? Just come back and you just stay here.
Well, to answer that, Jared...
Speak to the enemy.
To answer that, Jared, I think it's a bit of a Sisyphean task, to tell you the truth. I mean, as a military historian, we cannot escape, nor do I want to escape, the fact that we as a group continue to rub up against Anzac mythology. Now, that is both an insurmountable, it seems, sometimes challenge, but it's also an opportunity. People are interested in these things, even if you get very few thank yous, quite a few abusograms, I might have to say. And I understand that. Mythology and nation building and people's conception of what it is to be Australian are innately wrapped up in the ideas and images of Anzac, which have their roots in a historical event. My simple point would be, and the point I tried to make, is that I'm a historian. I see my task as to try to get as close to, no, we can never be there to the nth degree, as close to accurately portraying or describing events of the past as they happened. I'm not a sociologist. I'm not a mythologist. I think Anzac's great. I think it's, generally speaking, a pretty positive social message. I think it has its exclusivities and some other issues associated with it, but I think as far as foundation myth goes, it's a great thing. The trouble arises, is, if you want to call it that, is when people's imbibing of this myth and imagery becomes their conception of history because they're not the same. And to try to provide a corrective to that, or to suggest things weren't as people might think they are, the Japanese were never coming south, the Kokoda Trail did not save Australia from invasion. Discussing these types of shibboleths wins no friends. At the same time, the public and the debate generally seems pretty interested in these things. I can't answer the question up, Gerard, other than to say the issue is there, it's inescapable, we bump up against it daily. I think we have very little impact, I'm sorry to say, on the public imagination. But the job is there to be done.
Okay, so there's a question. Go down the back and then we'll come up here, yeah? Don't stand in front of a camera, okay? Yeah.
Menzies, in September 1939, announced that it was his melancholy duty to announce that because of the persistent failure of Germany to withdraw from Poland, Britain was at war, and as a consequence, Australia was at war. Was that an unfortunate choice of words, or was it something else? Did it indicate that he had no independent decision-making role?
The trouble with that quote, and how it's interpreted by most people, is this somehow is some sort of arbitrary decision by an ardent imperialist without reference to Parliament or anything else like that. Well, to some extent, that's so. Menzies did not use parliamentary procedure to commit to war. But all things in context, the Australian war book, Australian policy making, Australian military planning had 4 months before that announcement been preparing to declare war should a general war in Europe break out. My direct answer to your question is a very unfortunate set of words because it's misled people into Menzies' actions, his understandings and that of his government at the time. Far more realistic and far more cynical than people generally suspect. And the cable traffic between the High Commissioners, between people like Bruce, clearly bears this out. Menzies' nobody's fool. He's not Britain's fool, despite the fact that he's personally an imperialist at heart.
There's a question here.
Yeah, would you say that Germany was in the Middle East? And therefore we were in the Middle East defending the Middle East because of Middle East oil. The reason why Germany goes into Russia is to get the oil of Batum and Batum. And the reason why Japan comes down into Herbert War is because they have no war unless it gets oil, unless it gets to Burma. But oil somehow is behind all the rat campaigns.
Not in this case. No, and the British had a history in Egypt for a long time.
Yeah.
The oil, the Middle Eastern oil you're talking about isn't significantly developed until after the Second World War period. There is significant amounts of oil coming from places even like America at the time. I would agree there is because of Hitler's mindset and other reasons, the experience of World War I, the German imperative is to take Romania for its oil and to hold it, despite the fact that synthetic oil during the war is a far higher proportion. No. There are British interests in North Africa that need protecting. The Australian division, one division initially, the 6th, followed by others, was initially bound for France. Italian entry into the war, Italian position in Libya, created a threat in Egypt that the Western Desert Force and Australian divisions were sent to meet. No, I don't. This is not about oil. This is
about
Egypt.
Japan?
Go on.
What about Japan? I mean, Japan.
All right. Okay. What about Japan?
The Japanese drive for the co-prosperity sphere is resource-driven. Forced into that position, depending on what side of the fence you sit on, by pretty strict embargoes of things like petroleum and other products from the Americans. Yes, the Japanese drive is to secure an economic exclusive economic zone.
Tom.
Considering that one of the justifications for the Marshall Plan was the containment of the threat of communism in Europe, do you think there was a failure or a deficit in critical thinking by the Australian politic in relation to the possible development of the domino, or the concept of the domino theory and its reality?
We know now, and we will teach now, that ideas like the domino theory or the international communist movement, the Comintern, or the idea that all of these revolutions in places like Southeast Asia were all driven from Moscow is a fallacy. And we know that now. That's not what it is. Vietnam and a number of other countries we're talking about are essentially civil wars. Our problem at the time is we're viewing the world, like the Americans and the rest of the West, through a Cold War prism. Anything that happens is orchestrated from Moscow or from Beijing. That's not reality. That's how we interpret the war at the time. And that creates problems for policy and strategy making. Only now, with the distance of time and access to archival material, are we aware that the Soviets had no control, so to speak, in places like Vietnam. I think it's a problem. It's a problem for policy making at the time. The Cold War context colours the interpretation of events that occur in Africa and all over the world. But they don't accept the essential domestic nature of these conflicts. Hence, our strategies can be misguided.
But you're saying they can be misguided, but they were still made for the right reasons, for what were regarded the right reasons at the time.
Yes, absolutely. Having said all that, this domino theory was not just a belief held by government, it was a belief held by the Western world as far as Southeast Asia was concerned. If your assumption is Moscow is pulling the strings, these countries are falling, it's a logical deduction. The fact that it wasn't the case, we can say that now. But at the time, it's reality.
Wouldn't that vision be, and I'm not joking, be compared with like children overboard and weapons of mass destruction which come through from our leaders, whether it's passed on by another nation for us to absorb, but, you know, reading the paper, watching television, that's the sort of stuff that most people in this room and most people outside this room would initially feel strongly about.
Okay.
And until it's turned over.
Well, and I think my response to that question would be, I think there's a difference there. I think some of the things you're talking about are spin and politicised use of the press. The secret and confidential cable traffic I'm talking about was never for public consumption. Bears out the fear of things like the domino theory at the same time. This is why I say it is a government perception, not a spin doctrine at the time. Perhaps that would be the difference I'd make there.
Michael? I take your point about the self-interest that prompted Australia's participation. But please don't regard anything I say as in defence of the appalling Pilger. But surely it's perceptions of self-interest that prompt those decisions. And the perception of self-interest that may well emerge from a country like Australia, which was still very much part of the British heritage, where people still refer to going to England as going home, for example, to what extent are perceptions of self-interest influenced heavily by the ties, many emotional, to Britain? In other words, I have difficulty having a clear division between your rejection of emotion and the reality of the perception.
I think I understand. I understand what you're saying. Now, my words perhaps unwise if the impression you take away is that emotional and sentiment are not part of the story. They are absolutely part of the story. These are the wars we're talking about. Of course they're part of the story. But we need to make distinction about what parts of the community we're talking about here. The comments I made, I was talking about the factors influencing the decision made by political elites, not by the public. The public thinks all sorts of things. The public is the ones that get to do the volunteering and putting on of uniforms and going overseas. That is not the same, not the same set of factors, in my opinion, that drive elites to make decisions. Yeah? Particularly in a case like World War I, where those ties are very strong, those ties of sentiment and kinship, I would not discount the fact that they are present, but to understand that type of sentimentality as the basis of elite decision-making is to misinterpret the story. That's not to say it's not an important or powerful dynamic for the Australia story or the public story, but I'm talking about the decision maker's story, and they're not the same thing.
The other people's war thing is not really just Australia, is it? Because if you take the United States and the two world wars and their very strict idea about how to get involved in battles and lend money and the lend less thing, whatever. I mean, they really didn't enter the war until they were actually attacked themselves. So in a sense, they have a very strong feeling about it, just as much as we do, and so it's not really just us, is it?
Yeah, perhaps you're right, Anne. I mean, the Americans, as you say, certainly did maintain an isolationist policy. That's to do with American domestic politics more than anything else. However, my feeling of talking to American colleagues and reading American military history is the Americans, generally speaking, and generalisations are always dangerous, embrace their wars more often than not as moral causes or crusades in terms of right and wrong, and that's justification itself. I have not found many American authors trying to describe a commitment to a war as a product of foreign coercion, as a product of being tricked or forced or pressured, because Americans are usually the dominant partner. So perhaps that's the difference there.
They did wait till they were attacked.
Well, not entirely. Not entirely. Not even in World War II. I mean, we have Lend-Lease going on before that. It's the president's problem to get Congress on side, but the intention is there.
Then we go down the back. Yes, Mark?
I just have a follow-up. I'm having difficulty with your point about it's the leaders rather than the people. I mean, in the First World War, there was a referendum, the referenda on conscription, for example, clearly indicated what some attitudes were in the society. And it seems to me, I don't know whether you want to become a forecaster as well as a historian, but the change in the nature, in the makeup of Australia, with now 25% of Australians not being born in Australia and probably a great proportion of them not being of British backgrounds, maybe the perception of our self-interest is changing dramatically over that time.
Again, I think that you're referring to the general population, if you like. I've reflected on this a little bit myself. I tend to think the difference, if there's a difference, is that it's to do with social attitudes to authority. It's to do with attitudes to government and government decision-making. It's to do with the flow of information, which we have at our fingertips now in a way we certainly didn't, even in the 40s. I think the average citizen now has the tools and the attitude to question things in a way that they weren't questioned in the early part of the 20th century. Now, I think for me, that's as much a social construct, a feeling about being a citizen, your role in society, as it is the balance of the makeup of who is an Australian and who isn't, for that matter. But that's just my personal feeling there. I think we have a different view about the role of government, government's authority, and what we can and can't do as citizens as we did in the past. To protest, for example, before the 60s was not the done thing. That had social ramifications, negative ones. Yeah? In the period nowadays and onwards, it doesn't carry the same stigmas. So I think this whole idea of the respectability, all these sorts of issues have a role to play there about attitudes to decisions like those to go to war.
The back, yeah.
In human terms, the context and the role and the concept of a citizen soldier is changing, has changed, and is quite challenging now.
Yeah.
Would you care to comment?
Yeah, the citizen soldier issue is a really interesting one because that is a social phenomenon, not a military one. When we talk about Australian citizen soldiers, the Boer War period, up to World War II, if you like, what we are talking about is the importation of a British militia tradition. Now, that's got a lot of connotations attached to it. The British militia tradition is that these soldiers exist as part-time soldiers to defend their homes, to defend their nation, not to go abroad, not to fight external to the country. That's why the First Defence Act in 1904 is framed that way. Australia, that's why there's an AIF, because we can't send the militia overseas. That's not the same as rejecting the idea of fighting overseas. They're different things. It's just a comment on the idea of being compelled to do so, if that sort of makes sense. If we're talking about the Boer War, there is a clear assumption and an accurate assumption that should a war like that in South Africa break out, there will be volunteers from throughout the empire, and there are more than they can handle. Yeah. But at the same time, the Defence Act forbids Australian soldiers to serve overseas. The mistake here is to think that Australians don't want to fight in support of the empire. But it's not that at all. We're talking about social traditions here. Yeah, but is that sort of what you mean?
I'm thinking way back in Roman times when the soldiers went in the non-agricultural time, whereas now the complex in which the army serves and it affects families and loss of life and the whole thing is a revamp. You've talked a bit in communication and information and the whole political bit.
Okay. No, I was just going to say, I think I understand more what you're asking now. The regular military in Australia is a post-World War II phenomenon. I think that's important for how Australians view wars. When we have conflicts now, we have a small professional group, and not a mass army, who are all volunteers, who already are in the army before they go on these deployments to places whose names you'll recognise. I think that's different, even from Vietnam, where we had pseudo-conscripts and the rest of it, because the community, the wider community, doesn't hear very much about it. And what it does hear is not from soldiers, who are a pretty small and insular group. It's from media releases put out by the Department of Defence. So the public's understanding of what is going on is filtered nowadays in a way it couldn't be filtered in the world wars, even Vietnam, because of the mass participation. So I think that does make a difference as to how we view conflicts.
There's a question there. Yeah. Yes.
In the First World War, Australia had to do something quickly because New Guinea was part of the German colony. We had no alternative but to go to war straight away to get rid of Germany as a colony.
Yeah, the offensive power of German New Guinea was not very significant. We've always had our eyes on New Guinea. The Queenslanders invaded New Guinea in the 1880s. Without British approval, by the way. The British were quite upset because it was actually the Queensland presence in New Guinea which encouraged the Germans to land, to make a counter-landing. That's how it turned out. The Queenslanders. I say that because we're in Sydney, right? There were plans. There were standing military plans to annex that little Porsche. It's a minor event in the grand scheme of the war. We similarly had plans to annex Noumea, should we be at war with the French. I don't think we were threatened in any way by the presence of about 50 odd guys in German New Guinea. Soldiers.
There were German warships in the area.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Very briefly.
Vietnam wasn't just a simple, civil uprising. They don't see how the North could have won without being pretty strongly armed by the Russians.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. They are armed by the Russians in the same way that the South is armed by the Americans and the West. But Vietnam is a war between Vietnamese. It is essentially a war between Vietnamese. Our great mistake, strategically speaking, is to assume that it's a war between the Russians and the Americans and act accordingly. To not understand those real domestic issues is to not address them, is to fail. And it is a failure. None of our aims are achieved. In fact, the other guy's aims are achieved. It is a failure. One of the issues with any type of counterinsurgency, and Vietnam is not a counterinsurgency. This is one of the myths about it, thanks to Hollywood. The trouble for Vietnam is there's a heap of different wars all wrapped up into one. It's a conventional war in the northern I Corps area. It's an insurgency in the south around the Delta and these sorts of places. And the Americans have to deal with all these things. But to not... If we accept part of Vietnam is an insurgency, then the battlefield is not for a hill. The battlefield is for allegiance and imagination. That's what all insurgencies are about, the population. But to address that, you need to believe that. If you see the war, not in those terms, but as Russian aggression by a puppet state, then those things aren't addressed in that way. Perhaps in a place like Vietnam, they can't be addressed because our very presence in Vietnam, given it's a domestic concern, largely against foreign exploitation and occupation, which had occurred from the French and onwards, our very presence perhaps ruins that legitimacy that we would need to win that war of the imagination. But perhaps that's running down different rabbit holes.
Just as a final question, I guess of all the political figures who've made an entry into this debate would be Paul Keating during his couple of years as Prime Minister, where Mr. Keating, who did a lot of very beneficial things economically, but decided to get into the history debate and seemed to present the Pacific War as the only war in which Australia had an interest in being in, and every other war wasn't. Now, this is not the view of the Labor Party, but it was the view of Paul Keating. Now, what kind of impact did he make on that debate, or did he just pick up the threads that others were running with?
Well, he did pick up existing threads, but, I mean, this is a statement by a politician for political purposes. I mean, this is what this is. I mean, I don't know Mr. Keating. I haven't asked him about this topic, but I'm not so certain he's interested in the cold history of the matter. He's rather interested in making a statement that would appeal to a certain constituency. Now, the Battle for Australia Day, I think it's in September, resulted from those sorts of discussions. It hit a chord in the community at the time, but it's not history. It's a made-up event.
This is the Battle for Australia Day commemorates the victories in New Guinea, saying this was a battle where the future of Australia was at stake. So go on.
This is the Australian Thermopylae argument. Now, I always get into trouble and make people very unhappy when I talk about Kokoda. What I'm not talking about is the bravery, the sacrifice, all of the rest of it, of the small groups of Australians, relatively small in number, who fought that initial track campaign. All praise to those guys and their sacrifices and all the rest of it. But let's leave that to one side for a moment and talk about that event in wider historical and strategic context. It is of no significance. It is of no significance to the course and conduct of the Pacific War for a number of reasons. Firstly, there is never a Japanese plan to invade Australia, not even close. We can't be saved from a plan that was never going to be launched. We know for a fact from Japanese records that the only time the issue was raised was by a Japanese Navy position paper presented to the General Staff, which was rejected out of hand. Had that General Staff wanted to execute it, it's an impossibility. After Coral Sea and Midway and Guadalcanal, there are no ships. There are no troops. They're mostly in China. This could never have happened had the Japanese wanted it to happen, which they never did. Yeah? The advance of the South Seas Force over the trail is part of the Japanese Phase 2 strategy to make a cordon around the islands and positions already taken, and a strategy that was abandoned not long after it was taken up. Had Port Moresby been taken, the Japanese would have had nothing but an airfield they couldn't use because it couldn't be resupplied. With no navy or naval presence, thanks to the Americans, nothing could have been done of it. It is of no strategic significance. That's not undermining the sacrifice and the bravery of those that died there. It's giving it context. 2/3 of the South Seas Force that was designated to advance over the trail died at Guadalcanal because of the Americans. At the end of that trail, the Japanese invading force, the South Seas Force, chooses to withdraw back across the range. We don't make them. They choose to withdraw because they've got no food. There are acts of cannibalism at the end of the campaign by the Japanese. They also withdraw because they fear a counter-landing on the north coast, which happens. All things in context. I'm not talking about bravery or sacrifice. I'm talking about history.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
we're right on, I know there are more questions, but we're right on 7 o'clock, so I thought it was a good time to finish. As I mentioned, the copies of the edited collections, Janet Grundy's got them outside. I think it's very important that historians like Craig Stockings look at mythology. I remember Alan Martin saying, when he spoke here in his volume on the first volume on Robert Menzies, saying that no one in 1939 ever spoke about Australia fighting someone else's war. That was not a contemporary view, and the concept of other people's wars seemed to have developed later. It was not spoken much in Vietnam either in 1960, with relation to Vietnam in 1965. So what we've seen here tonight is Dr. Craig Stockings going through, looking at the mythology, stating his position, empirically based. There's been a lively debate. There's been important contributions he's made, and so far a relatively brief career in universities, but no doubt will be a long one. Certainly it's been a distinguished one already, and I know you've got other books in the planning system, and we'll hope you'll come back and speak to us again. But for tonight, thank you and well done. Yeah. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.